Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
And you're very welcome back. Now, Carol Cadwallader is a multi-award-winning British journalist whose investigative work exposed the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal linked to Trump's election in 2016. It led to the biggest fines in history being imposed on the social media giant on both sides of the Atlantic. However, Mark Zuckerberg's company and others have thrived more than ever since then, and these companies remain at the centre of worldwide concerns about truth, democracy, child welfare, of course. Carol Cadwallader is taking part in the Granard Booktown Festival is happening in 2 weeks' time, and she's on the line this morning. Carol, good morning.
Hello, good morning. Thanks for having me.
I hope you're in good form.
I am. I enjoyed that intro, a bit of Armageddon first thing in the morning. I thought that was a nice bit of dystopia to lead into this.
Because well, this is bread and butter for you, the end times.
Exactly. I'm glad that everybody, the great thing now is that everybody's joined me. So
exactly.
I've just been like Debbie Doomer for, you know, years, and now saying these tech companies aren't good people. And now everybody's joined me. So that's fun.
How do you cope with it all?
It's quite hard, actually. People agreeing with me is a sort of unusual state of affairs, shall we say.
We've been following you really closely since you exploded onto the global stage with that really scoop of the century, 2018. But we don't know perhaps a lot about your background. You grew up mostly in Wales, I believe.
I am. I'm a fellow Celt, yes. I'm in Wales, which explains everything, I think, really. Actually, it kind of does, because when, you know, I started looking into Brexit, and that was sort of the start of my sort of tech investigations, really, on this aspect. And that is English nationalism, essentially. Mm-hmm. So there is a theme there, perhaps.
And you in Wales, you were far from the powerful world that you one day be cracking open as a journalist. You do go to Oxford, though, don't you? And is that a culture shock?
I love it. You know, this is interesting. I don't usually get asked about these types of things.
Oh, gosh.
But yes, it was a culture shock. And actually, I think it was that first exposure to this is how power works. This is how, you know, I went to a comprehensive school in Wales, and which is very far from the centre of power. And then it was that sort of first insight into how the world works, really. And I think, actually, you know, it's sort of interesting being a journalist in that you get to go into things and talk to people and be on the inside to have that sort of insight. But if you're a proper journalist anyway, you are on the outside. And you never actually joined the club. So maybe that does all stem from there.
You had a fascinating early career. I mean, you were in the Daily Telegraph for a stint, which would be a surprise to people knowing you as a crusading journalist from the left-wing press. And then you kind of do things in reverse, don't you? Because sometimes you have a big career in journalism, then write the best-selling novel, but you did that quite early on.
Well, that seems a long time ago now. I mean, back in the day, the Daily Telegraph was a very good newspaper in that it very much was church and state. So when I worked there, Boris Johnson was a columnist for it, but the opinion side, the comment side, the editorials were very separate from the news reporting.
Yeah.
And it was very much, you know, a lot of the news reporters had sort of come up, you know, had joined local newspapers when they were young and, you know, did it really. So it was really good for me in terms of learning from people who were, you know, just sort of true journalists through and through in that way, true reporters. And I mean, I think what we, you know, one of the biggest problems we have in Britain now is just that there's so little actually independent media. It's, you know, it's just highly partisan and it's highly right-wing dominated. And The Guardian has been, you know, the sort of standard bearer, really, of kind of independent journalism where it's not beholden to a proprietor. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you followed much of what's happened with The Observer, but, you know,
so
if people don't know, that's just been sold now and to a set of investors who we don't actually even know who they all are. And my colleagues and I tried to protest it and went on strike. And which was really good fun, actually. I have to recommend going on strike.
It was a 4-day strike.
It was, but they actually sold us while we were on the picket line. So it wasn't all It was not. But I
the
feel
Guardian
that we learned
just
things through the process.
To bring people up to speed on it, the Guardian Group sold the Observer title.
Yes, that's right. Media. So it's the oldest Sunday newspaper in the world, and it's now been sold to this set of private investors. And you know, a huge number of my colleagues now are leaving.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a sad, it's a bit of a sad moment for us journalistically.
You're out of the Observer as well now.
I'm out. Yeah, I my great claim to fame is that I got sacked twice on the same day.
Oh, really?
In that, because all of our contracts were terminated with the Guardian when they agreed
okay.
to sale.
So it's automatic termination. Yes.
Yeah. There's a, and
you had a freelance contract, didn't you? Is that and that was
that's right.
Terminated
well, it's I mean, it's a pseudo freelance contract in that I worked there for 20 years full time. But I was always kept on a freelance contract. So I feel I'm going into a bit of the weeds here, but it was
I'm worried too. but I did read, I did read that they were inviting you back to talk in their defence and are planning to defend independent journalism. But the Observer is an important place for you. It's where you launch a lot of stories on big tech. Before Facebook, there's Amazon, Google. But the big one is 2018, the huge scoop on the stolen data and how it was used in the US election and elsewhere. Extraordinary story. What is the point for you, Carol, when you realise that you have the expose of a lifetime in your hands?
I mean, it was really early on in that it felt like such an enormous story because at the time, Steve Bannon, you know, he was the chief advisor to Donald Trump, the president, and Steve Bannon had been the vice president of this firm, and I was talking to this whistleblower who'd worked inside the firm, if you remember him, this sort of pink-haired guy, Christopher Wiley.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he had the receipts. So he had, you know, he'd worked directly with Steve Bannon. And he I'd heard these rumors about how the company had acquired this massive amount of Facebook data, illicitly through a personality quiz. And this guy, you know, had the receipts for that. He literally had the receipts. And it felt very precarious right from the off because we were just dealing with these, you know, very powerful, very dangerous people. And these very powerful people in America. It was also these very powerful people in Britain. Because, you know, that there was also the Brexit campaign, the Nigel Farage, you know, crew had talked openly about using this company. And there was sort of half the British establishment on this board as well. So it felt really, I knew that I had a really big story from the off. And, you know, I initially published parts of the story using Chris as an anonymous source,
right?
And those did go incredibly viral. It was, you know, people were really shocked, I think, because it was sort of showing these links between Trump and between Brexit and also to Russia. That was the sort of third sort of point of it, and it showed that sort of, you know, the thing which was the weapon here was data. It was people's personal data, and it was, you know, information. And so it did feel that I'd sort of stumbled on this sort of, you know, secret world of propaganda and power and influence. And, you know, I always knew it was going to be a hornet's nest, and that's why it took a really long time, actually, to be able to bring him out. And
You spoke to him for a year. Is that right, before you...
Exactly. And then, you know, and it kind of went on for years after that.
But the ramifications were extraordinary, not just obviously devastating to Cambridge Analytica, which is destroyed, but you probably didn't expect the fallout to impact Facebook so severely.
That's right. I mean, I always sort of refer to it. We knew exactly that it was going to be sort of devastating to Cambridge Analytica, and not least because we'd worked with Channel 4. They did this undercover reporting in which you know, that you could see, there were sort of extraordinary bits in it where this the CEO, Alexander Nix, was, you know, talking about the work that they did in foreign countries and how they would even, you know, they would seek to flying girls, he talked about, to, you know, to bribe politicians. I mean, it was sort of amazing, at least sort of shady sort of behaviour that they, that, you know, which has been, sorry, that sounds, that's now been exposed. But I really hadn't expected, I mean, Facebook, I always sort of say, blew themselves up on our doorstep. They mishandled it so badly, you know, they went quiet for 3 days and then finally Mark Zuckerberg stepped out and said that he was sorry. And it was this, you know, it was these gross violations that really serious offences that we discovered afterwards. So Facebook got fined $5 billion as a result of the Cambridge Analytica scandal by the FTC. That was a record. And yeah, $100 million by the SEC in America. And, the amazing thing about it is the ramifications from it are still absolutely still rolling on. So Mark Zuckerberg was actually deposed 2 weeks ago. He had to give evidence to attorneys for hours over what he knew when about Cambridge Analytica.
Wow.
Because there are still lawsuits rolling on, because there's still been this key question about they failed to tell shareholders that there had been this data breach. They failed to tell users. So it's that classic thing they sort of say, it's not the crime, it's the cover up. And that is still playing out to this day.
In fact, they essentially changed the name. They rebranded as Meta as a result of this entire...
I refuse, actually. I have to say is that people do now refer to it as Meta, and I'm just like, it's still Facebook.
They tried
to wipe the stink of the scandal off, but it's still there.
Because it was so badly damaged, not least in Ireland, where it's regulated on behalf of the European Union. It's been fined $2.5 billion in the space of 1 2-year period for various data and privacy breaches by our regulator here.
What's its reputation in Ireland now? I mean,
a celebrated company, never criticised by any government official I can find, but a celebrated company because of the number of jobs in Ireland. Obviously, we're a centre of tech. That's one of the reasons it's kind of well looked after. It's comfortable in Ireland. But I suppose the question is, Facebook has become really powerful, more so even since then, in terms of its valuation, its stock price and so on. In fact, I think even the $5 billion fine resulted in its share price going up that day because the business model was not affected. And that's the crucial point.
That's right. That's right. I mean, that's right. I mean, the whole kind of experience of it, to me, you know, led to this understanding that we essentially live in this age of zero accountability. And we live in an age when, you know, we have a very romantic idea of journalism still. We still think of Watergate, you know, the idea that journalism could topple a president. That we do, you know, that world does not exist anymore. And essentially these companies operate with total impunity for the reasons that you just mentioned. And nobody has, you know, was ever held to account for it. I mean, you know, Facebook, you know, we know has done worse than that. You know, we know that the United Nations, you know, refers to them having an instrumental role in the genocide in Myanmar. There's never been any consequences to that either. And so it's this impunity really of these companies that is why we are now. I mean, what's so clear now is that Silicon Valley is part of the Trump regime. And I think we do have to call it a regime. That is what we are seeing. Mm. And, you know, this merger between Silicon Valley and this, you know, would-be autocrat is a sort of wholly new type of power in the world. And, you know, I've been calling it broligarchy,
yeah,
because it's not just oligarchy. It's the tech bros version of it. And, you know, I think if you look at what Elon Musk is doing, he's not looking to profit from the government per se. I mean, that's just part of it. He's looking to replace government. I mean, that's what it's this technocratic urge to replace the federal workers with large language models, which, of course, he controls.
Of course, they will both say it's all about streamlining and creating better efficiency, whether it's federal workers to save costs, to trim the fat, as they say. I suppose the main problem is in democratic countries like our own here, we've just decided not to regulate these companies, as indeed Britain. And there's been an election in Britain. There was one in Ireland last year. And although there's huge conversations around adolescence, which focused on Instagram and the damage to children's welfare, it never features in election debates. There's never pressure on politicians to create regulations for them.
Well, it's always been this thing, isn't it, is that the politicians also depend on these platforms and their tools to reach voters. So they're always in this kind of conflicted position. And, you know, the whole thing. But I think, you know, we've got to really wake up and understand, you know, that in the US, they totally failed to regulate tech. They totally failed to break it up, which is that was the key thing they needed to do, because these are massive monopolies. And, you know, we're seeing the consequences of that. I mean, you know, everything that we see happening now, it isn't politics. You know, this is technology. It's our information ecosystem which underpins everything that we're seeing. It's an earthquake because of the world gets its news and information, sadly, not from RTE. It's getting it from social media. I mean, the vast majority. That's that mainstream social media is mainstream media now, and it's really difficult to know what's false and what's true. It just all looks the same. And that's why I think, you know, we have to understand this moment is not just an election cycle. There's something deeply structural which is happening in the world. And until we reckon with that, I don't see there's a political way out of it.
The consequences of the story were obviously huge for the companies you've outlined there, but they're also pretty enormous for you, aren't they? And the online trolling you faced was relentless.
Yeah, I mean, it was a combination in my case because I was sued. So there was this lawsuit, and if you're involved in, you know, long term, if it's 3 years, you're really silenced. You can't actually talk about the matter of which you're being sued over. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there was this massive coordinated online campaign, and I sort of could deal with either of those separately. But it was the sort of combination of them together. Every step in the lawsuit sort of provided fuel for the next wave of massive abuse. It was designed to silence me, and it did. You know, it was there was a sort of whole period I just took myself out of the public eye. I took myself off online. And, you know, this is the model. I'm not the first person this has happened to. It's, you know, I have a sort of network of friends who are female journalists across the world who got targeted in the same way. And it's very much what is going to be coming now for journalists in America, for other people. It's not just journalists anymore. It's other public figures. It's this sort of hybrid attack of both these weaponized lawsuits plus this online incitement to violence. And you can say it's instructive. It's that I think that I've understood that social media is a weapon, mm-hmm. in a way that information is a weapon. And I think, you know, we can see now that Elon Musk is, you know, targeting people in that way very visibly. We can all see that now. I suppose I just sort of learnt it firsthand earlier, perhaps, than other people.
Well, that's a terrible ordeal you went through, particularly that trolling. You went off for a while, but big tech, it's time for it to work for you now, isn't it? Because you've left legacy media and you've moved to Substack.
Yeah, well, that's right. As I say, I became a spokesperson during our strike, and I also investigated the funding of the new owners of The Observer. So they declined to, when they bought it, they declined to offer me a job there. Mm. But I'd already, to be honest with you, I'm really comfortable with that, is that I want to be independent and I want to be able to write what I need to write about. And so I set up a Substack newsletter, How to Survive the Broligarchy, just before Christmas, actually, to start writing about this issue. And it's, you know, freedom is kind of scary because you can write about anything. But it's also liberating as well. And what I, you know, what I'm really liking about it is it's grown really quickly. I'm really grateful. You know, 65,000 people have subscribed to it. And you really feel that sort of close relationship, actually, with the readers.
It's personalised, isn't it? Because they've obviously selected you. They know your work.
That's right.
It seems to be the future.
And I think it is. It's really, you know, one of the things we see happening now is that sort of trust in institutions, all institutions, is going down, and that includes news organisations.
Yeah.
But I think people are seeking out voices that they trust. And I think I'm really fortunate in that people do understand that I will say what I think, you know, what I believe to be true. And like I say, is that I wouldn't be able to do that at The Observer anymore. And so I am sort of incredibly grateful for people who are, you know, do still want to read my work. And I mean, you know, the whole thing is that through that legal battle, it really was the readers who supported me. And I think, you know, 30,000 people contributed to my crowdfunder. I'm, you know, incredibly grateful for that. But I sort of feel that this is, we need to rebuild the media from the ground up in this sort of grassroots basis.
So you're doing a bit by bit, and you have your
Substack. It's the only sustainable model now, really. Yeah. So that's, it actually feels like a very exciting moment to be trying to do that. And it's, you know, it's really happening now in America too. There's all these refugees from the Washington Post. Exactly the same thing happened there. And a lot of them are turning up on Substack, which is another of these sort of terrible tech platforms. But there is a sort of community of independent journalists.
It's subscription based, for audiences
that emerging there. But we need to, I want to sort of, there are better platforms. But at the moment, it's where there's an audience. And as a journalist, it's like you go where the audience is.
It's where the thinking people seem to be gravitating towards, isn't it? And you also have podcasts as well. Very interesting stuff on stalking, which we've no time to get into today, unfortunately. But we will another time. But people can look up the podcast. And it's called Stalked, simply, isn't it?
It's called Stalked. It's a BBC podcast. It's at number 4 in the charts, I think, now. And it's a horrible story. It happened to my former stepdaughter. And another campaign of abuse and violence and threats over
online.
Years, and also, you know, technology is a big part of that. All stalking these days is cyber stalking. It involves using tech tools in some ways or another.
Pretty devastating story, but she came out the right side of it,
and
it is a fascinating one. It's been really interesting talking to you, Carol Cadwallader. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry I took us off course a bit there, but hey.
That's where you go, because you know a bit of everything. And to get tickets for people to join, you're going to be joining News Nobility with Brian Dobson. That's who you're in conversation with.
Yes, amazing. In Granard. That's really, I love coming to Ireland. That's why it's always such a joy to go to an Irish festival. They're always such fun. So
brilliant.
I'm really looking forward to that.
That's in County Longford. Granardbooktownfestival.ie is the place to go. And Stalked is available wherever you get your podcasts. But Carol Cadwallader, good to hear you in good form, despite everything.
Thanks so much.
Enjoy your day. Bye-bye.
Email Oliver@rte.ie.